Good evening or good morning, depending on where you listen to this, everybody. Welcome to Hoops HD for a very special audio podcast we have this evening. First of all, I'm your host, Chad Sherwood, joining us from Bracketeer.org, Rocco Miller, regular Hoops HD panelist, David Griggs. But our very, very special guest tonight is the... incoming NCAA Tournament Selection Committee Chairman himself, Tom Burnett, Southland Conference Commissioner, Chairman of the committee, as I just mentioned. Tom, first of all, thanks for joining us. How are you tonight?
Guys, it's a pleasure to be with you, and it's great we're talking about hoops on a normal schedule, we hope.
Yeah, so tonight's kind of exciting. I know the other two realize this. The first exhibition game involving a D1 team is tomorrow, and there is a game of some sort every day between now until the day after you guys get done on the Monday after Selection Sunday. So this is probably one of my favorite days of the year just because it's the longest expanse of college basketball ahead of us. So,
wow, that's good to know. I just know we're tipping off in 3 weeks from tonight, so
yep.
Officially. But, yeah, we do know we're in scrimmage and exhibition season ahead of us. And, you know, it's, again, just really great to be back on what we hope remains a normal schedule for the upcoming season.
Yeah.
Tom, if I can, just by way of your background, I see that you went to Louisiana Tech. Is that correct? And spent some time at the American South Conference as well.
I did. I was at Louisiana Tech. We had a basketball player named Carl Malone, you might be familiar with, when I was in school there. And pretty special. Really was my introduction to the NCAA tournament with the Carl Malone teams at Louisiana Tech. That actually the 85 team went to the Sweet 16, lost in overtime to Oklahoma. Not that I remember any of that or it sticks with me, but that was my introduction to the tournament back as a college student. And, you know, had a chance to then go after I graduated to work at the American South. And that was a short-lived conference. But I believe in a 4-year period, we had two at-large teams make it to the tournament back then. So pretty good level of basketball played. And then that evolved into the Sun Belt, where I was until late 02. And then I was fortunate enough to succeed Greg Sankey here at the Southland. And, of course, he's gone on to maybe a couple of bigger and better things at the SEC. But, yeah, that's kind of my background and timeline.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, I remember the American South. There's probably not a lot of people listening to this even that do, but that's how much, you know, how involved, you know, I remember the Great West Conference too. So Rocco, let me toss it over to you here for a second. I know you had a few questions.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Tom, and it's a pleasure to meet you. I am, you know, I'm kind of the bracketologist here of the bunch. We all do it to a degree, you know, and I'm not sure if you're familiar, but Hoops HD for a long time now has done a mock selection committee simultaneously with the actual selection committee. So, Chad, our host here, he is a master of the process. It's really incredible. We do Skype calls for four or five straight days, right, Chad? And so just being exposed to that at just the mock level has really allowed me personally to sink my teeth into the process more. So we understand that like 2020 was a disaster. We didn't get the tournament. You probably just got the process underway. And then last year, you had to make some really difficult decisions. I think, you know, you think about teams like SMU, who only had like 12 games played. St. Louis had a ton of games canceled. There are countless examples, and it was really difficult, at least from our standpoint, to just, you know, directly say they deserve to be in or deserve to be out either way. Just can you shed some light on maybe how challenging both of the COVID years have been for the committee, and maybe any lessons that you'll take away for future years?
Yeah, absolutely, Rocco. Thanks for that. I will tell you, 2020 is an experience that none of us want to relive. But, you know, when you think back, we were in position. Obviously, we had gotten through the regular season. We were kind of ready to go with everything. And then certainly news started breaking. I think the Rudy Gobert news out of the NBA broke. And, you know, things started to kind of go downhill from there. And it was pretty clear in about our second day of deliberations that we number one, we had to push the pause button And then after a long drawn out wait, we kind of learned that the NCAA was not going to be going forward. Again, not only with March Madness, but certainly all the other championships that followed. And of course, we all experienced a rough stretch after that. You know, the 21 experience when we went to Indianapolis, I think people, if they remember kind of where we were a year ago, we were maybe starting to play regular college football. We weren't quite sure about the basketball season. You know, we were delayed until later in November, if you remember the start. And like you say, we it was kind of rough. It was start stop. Some teams couldn't get, you know, a lot of games in. But remarkably, there were quite a few teams that got quite a few in, and really a representative schedule that the committee could work with. And, you know, that led to our process. I don't want to call anything normal in 21, but, you know, the committee's selection process was fairly straightforward and by the book. If you're familiar with the policies and procedures, and I know the three of you are, and a lot of people listening are, but we were able to follow that. We didn't really have to stray from the longstanding policies that the committee had. The bigger issue was, you know, how to play the tournament, obviously. And, you know, the NCAA staff, the committee gets way too much credit here, but Dan Gavitt, Joanne Scott, all of that, those staff members, and the community of Indianapolis, just really moved mountains to make this tournament happen. And, you know, as strange as it was, as difficult as it might be, you know, we had the unfortunate issue with VCU on the positive test, and they had to go home. But to get through that tournament in the manner we did, I'm really not prone to hyperbole, but I will tell you that the staff and the folks in Indianapolis might have saved this enterprise to some degree. Had we not been able to play that tournament, and likewise the women's tournament in San Antonio, you know, I'm not quite sure what this would look like now. So I certainly feel very fortunate that, you know, we were able to do that. And, you know, it's an experience you don't want to go through again. We were sequestered in Indianapolis for 29 days. And while they treated us well, 29 days is still 29 days, as you guys might imagine. But two very different experiences in 20 and then in 21. And really the hope right now is everything goes according to plan and we can play a normal a tournament as we know it at the 14 different sites, beginning with the first four in Dayton. And of course, concluding with what we hope is just a fantastic celebratory Final Four in New Orleans, in early April. So that's a little bit about that experience that I don't want to relive again. And I don't think my fellow committee members want to relive again.
Yeah. And to, again, like you, to not get too much into hyperbole, but I think it was really special and really important that that tournament happened, even though it had to happen under really unusual circumstances. I think that, what, did they let you all out an hour a day to go run around the baseball field or something like that? And, you know, at night you heard stories of teams being out on their balcony because you couldn't go anywhere else and kind of yelling back and forth, like just a really unusual setting. But something you touched on, it was really important that that got played, because if your association, be it as a fan, employee, or whatever, is with a league that typically only gets one team and relies heavily on the NCAA tournament basketball revenue, not just for basketball, but for your entire athletic department, what would have happened to a lot of those conferences, like the one that you're the commissioner of, if that revenue suddenly went away? So I thought it was important, not just for basketball and not just for fans at a time where I think we needed a diversion maybe more than ever, but for all of the other sports that rely on that revenue to continue to play and exist.
Well, it was absolutely critical to get the tournament played. And, you know, again, the revenue, as you mentioned, it's the lifeblood for, you know, a lot of us at this level. If you don't play FBS football, we play at the FCS level here. And, you know, you don't have the major revenue from the college football playoff or large media agreements. The basketball tournament distribution is really everything. And
it is.
You've nailed it. It's exactly what you said. It funds everything we do. It helps fund football at our level. It funds all the women's sports. It funds the spring sports. So just absolutely critical that we played that. And you kind of realized as we got through the Sweet 16, you kind of, it kind of hits you that, hey, we're really going to do this. And
yeah,
it's going to happen. And, you know, television is going to be obligated by its contract for distribution. And we all celebrate that, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, Tom, let me ask you this. We did see a lot of changes, as you mentioned, especially over last year with the way the committee ran things because of COVID. Do you think there are any changes that you saw in the way the process worked that whether the committee or just the season itself that maybe were for the better, maybe things that we should keep moving forward? Or should we just forget it and go back 2 years and start over?
Well, it's a great question too. As much as I'd like to forget about it, I will say this: there was a unique experience in Indianapolis, and I'm presuming it was similar in San Antonio for the women. But you know, it was people were so happy to play this tournament; they were willing to do anything and everything. And you know, a lot of us, we had to go through all the testing protocols last year, and you know, we had to send our automatic qualifying team, you know, with 7 days of test and before they could get to Indy. And then they had to go through quarantine when they got there. But I will tell you, we had 12 practice courts in the Indianapolis Convention Center. And it was so spirited and it was so neat and cool. Because remember, we're all college basketball fans. And you would see, you know, this coach walk by or that player or... Right. You know, these media members that had a limited bit of access. It was really neat to have everyone under one roof. And a lot of people started to think about, well, could this be something that we could do in a given year or bring everyone together? And I will tell you that there may be some merit to that, but I think there were others who thought that, well, you know, this is a national tournament. We're normally at the 14 different sites, and you know the tournament is played in different regions and such. And you know, would that be fair to those communities that have done so well in supporting this event? But I tell you, it made you think, and there was some merit there. And of course, that's led to some other things that have been talked about, you know, such as maybe the men and women playing a Final Four together, or maybe once you get to the Sweet 16 level, maybe that you bring all the teams together. We found it was possible, but is it realistic based on what cities, communities have committed in the future with upcoming tournaments? I'm not quite sure, but I think we found, obviously, in a moment where we had to make it work, it worked pretty well. And I think some people saw some merit in some of the camaraderie and such, multiple teams in hotels and, you know, getting a chance to see each other as they practiced.
Yeah. Tom, I had a question just about how you measure essentially a square against a circle, relatively speaking. And I guess one of the things that we have a soft spot for are what we call under the radar teams and conferences. We hate the term mid-major, but in the hierarchy of things, you have, at least the way we see it, you have the Power Five conferences and you lump the Big East in with that as well. And then you have the next tier down, which are the regular multi-bid leagues that are really good, but not quite the power leagues. You know, you would have the American, the Atlantic 10, probably the West Coast, and I'm leaving one out, the Mountain West. And then you sort of get down to what's below that. And I don't know why, but for, especially the three of us, that's where we think the good stuff is. And one of the most exciting things each year is who's really good out of that under the radar group of about 20-ish, 21 conferences that typically only get one bid. And what you run into is a lot of frustration. I'll use last year, UC Santa Barbara, when you look at them on paper, they might not have the credentials that a mid-level team from a power conference has, but that's largely due to opportunity. And when you look at them, it's like, well, their credentials say 12, but when you look at them on the court, I would pick them head-to-head against anybody from the 8 line or below. How do you sometimes measure a team that you feel is better than that. Do you ever, okay, let me back up. Do you ever run into a situation to where you feel a team is better than their credentials? How do you evaluate that as a committee member? And is there anything to be said about what I would consider a circumstantial disadvantage? And I'll use the Big East for an example. Their TV deal basically gives them leeway to schedule maybe one or two games total that Fox does not have the rights to. So what they end up having to do is schedule a lot of bye games, or that limits who they can play in a lot of cases. So if you're a really good team from the Ohio Valley or the Horizon League or from the under the radar leagues of Belmont, for instance, and you're told you need to go out there and play and then nobody will play you, is that kind of taken into account what I would consider a circumstantial disadvantage for the under the radar schools?
It's a great question. And you mentioned square pegs, round holes, so to speak. And, you know, I will tell you, you mentioned you rattled off some conferences there, and, you know, as all of you know now, the Autonomy Five conferences are all represented on the committee now, and mm-hmm. the Big East is as well. And in fact, we've expanded the committee this year from 10 to 12 members. Yeah. So we've got a lot of new faces. But I'll also point out that you know, in addition to my role from the Southland, we have the commissioner from the SWAC, the commissioner from the Sun Belt, a representative from the MAC, the commissioner from the A-10, an AD from the Missouri Valley Conference. In previous years, we've had the Mountain West Conference in the room. We've had the Big South in the room on the committee. So you have a lot of different perspectives on basketball and the opportunities you mention. And what I will tell you, what one of the things that I've probably been most impressed in my committee experience is the conference monitoring program that we have in place, where every committee member, you know, has maybe up to six or seven conferences that they really have to be the expert on. And that comes through, obviously, watching a lot of basketball, as you guys might imagine, you know, upwards to a couple of hundred games a year. You know, you're keeping an eye, you're talking to those conferences that you monitor, and you really have a good feel. And I will tell you from my previous experience before I was on the committee, and I was just a under the radar conference commissioner, as you guys, I really love the phrase, by the way. You know, I just wanted them to get us right. I just wanted to know the committee and the person monitoring my conference was getting the Southland Conference right. Well, fast forward to my experience as a conference monitor, I had to make sure, because I knew how important it was, to get the Big South right, to get the Big Sky right, to get the Summit League right. And that is a really overwhelming kind of feeling, if you will, coming into the room, that you've got to get that conference right. And you've got to look at the opportunities they have. And if you're coming out of the Summit League or the Big South, for example, we know you're not going to have the night-to-night opportunity that a power conference is going to provide its teams. But also, too, there's such a thing as intent to schedule and, you know, the effort that was put into scheduling. And I think the committee is real quick to pick up. You know, I'm remembering Belmont a couple of years ago, 3 years ago now, I guess it was. I'm remembering other programs like that I believe were given a very fair shake by the committee. And Belmont had a great record and played in a really strong conference, you know, with Murray and the other OVC schools, but they didn't have as many opportunities as, say, Team X out of a power conference. And the committee recognizes that and really spends a lot of time on programs like that. But then also, too, as we seed all the way down and we get down to the fourth quadrant and we're talking about, you know, 13, 14, 15, and 16 lines, we're spending a lot of time to make sure we get those right. So I live in the world you speak of, and it's certainly very important to me. But my observation is that the committee has really given a really fair shake. Now, fair shake's in the eye of the beholder. And if your team is on the outside looking in, you may not agree. But I would tell you that the committee has done a really good job in acknowledging you know, that level of basketball and the opportunities they may or may not have to get into the tournament.
And that's, I mean, it's really refreshing to hear you say that. And I loved the Belmont selection a few years ago. I think one of the things they did, they won at Lipscomb, they won at Murray. They won, I want to say it was three games against teams that weren't probably under consideration, but against teams on the road that won all but one or two of their home games. And I remember asking someone, I want to say NC State, not to pick on them in particular. They had a couple of big home wins. And I just remember, I think the question we raised on the show is, if your AD was going to give you a $1 million bonus, if you did one of the following two things, beat NC State at home or went to Murray, Lipscomb, and I want to say it was Jacksonville State, whichever the third one was, and win all three of those, anybody that didn't pick NC State is absolutely nuts. Because one of the anyone that said beating NC State at home is that would be the harder thing to do is absolutely nuts. So one of the questions we're always asking isn't just how good or were the teams you beat or where are they ranked, but how hard was it to win the game that you won? Because some of those conferences you mentioned, it's hard to go to North Dakota State and win. It's hard to go to South Dakota State and win. It would be hard for a Power Five program to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we suffer in our league with a kind of a lack of some home opportunities, as you speak of. Most of our opportunities are on the road, and you know, we're going to snag a couple of those every now and then. But I think you're absolutely right. It's did you have an opportunity? And like you said, you know, going to Murray, Kentucky, going to Jacksonville, Alabama, it is really hard. And I've got places like that in our league, too, that I know why teams won't go to Lake Charles, Louisiana, or, Corpus Christi, Texas. They're great places to visit, by the way. But it's a tough out to think you're just going to walk in there and win a game. And conference play is tough no matter what conference you're in, no doubt.
Rocco, you had something?
Yeah, so Tom, I'm curious a little bit further about that. I do think last year's Drake example could maybe be thrown in there a little bit, but for different reasons, because, you know, if you look at the resume for Drake, they, unfortunately, they did have a big win at Kansas State early, but that ended up going all the way down to Q3 because Kansas State had a really tough year. But outside of that, there really wasn't much to write home about outside of the conference, but they did have such a amazing record. They also had injury things to deal with. And, the team that they brought to Indianapolis was able to take the whole thing to the wire with Loyola Chicago. So I thought you guys did a fantastic job to make sure they were included. And I do think it was for different reasons than just the intent to schedule. So I'm curious, the net has five factors. We know that two of those are margin of victory is capped at 10 points, right? But then the other is offensive efficiency, where it's possession by possession based. And so you talk to coaches out there like I have, like Nate Oates and others, who they'll leave their starters in all the way till the final horn, just being concerned about that possession data being manipulated a little bit. And so with all that being said, I'm just curious if in the last couple of years or these first few years in the net, are you seeing the strength of schedule kind of being overpowered a little bit by the efficiency numbers? Because I think with Drake's inclusion, we're starting to head that direction, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, what I would tell you on that, and again, keep in mind that net is one of, many things we're looking at. We're looking at all the metrics. Obviously, we've got a conference monitoring program that I mentioned as well, but I think we've every year we review the net, with the folks that help put that together. And, we run all sorts of tests. We ask questions, are we seeing any trending in this? And what I will tell you is that, as best I can understand it, some of those things didn't really play out. We didn't really see, maybe a team running up the score, even though, that can be capped. But I don't know that we were able to delineate anything out of the data that made us sound, well, here's a way that you can kind of game the net and play to your advantage. So, yeah, there might have been an isolated case here or there that someone could point to, but in the overall picture and the overall metric of NET, the evaluation tool, I don't think the committee has really seen overwhelming evidence that you know, something is up or someone's able to kind of rig the system, so to speak.
Understood.
Yeah. A net question. You mentioned efficiency. Is it adjusted efficiency or just straight efficiency?
It's an adjusted. Okay, yeah, that's an what adjusted I thought. Net yeah. efficiency. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you can't play a low level MEAC or SWAC team and then blow them out of the water. It's sort of like a batting average that takes into account how good the pitching is. It is adjusted. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. It's offensive efficiency minus defensive efficiency. And I'll remind you guys, I was not a math major in college. Okay. So that's where I would probably stop.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Actually, Tom. Yeah. I mean, we've actually spoken to David Warlock a couple of times, so I'm sure you know him very well. On the show, but how have you seen things change, really? Because you were there with the end of the RPI and the whole start of the NET era. As we've gone further and further into it, do you think it's been the right move to move to the NET more, or is it just, you know? And I know there's other ratings as well in the room besides the NET.
Yeah, and that's a great question. I would say that, you know, the RPI was around for decades and, you know, had been used. And, you know, there were a lot of questions. And really out of the coaches community, the NABC was really asking about how could we modernize our metric or one of the main metrics we use. And obviously with analytics, with other things like, you know, Sagarin and Ken Palm and KPI, BPI, I mean, you can go on, and those are all numbers we look at, that I think the coaches community really pressed upon the committee for a number of years, even before I was on the committee, to try to modernize it, you know, bring some of these analytics into it. And, you know, we think we've done that. We think the NET's done a good job. I think for the most part, it would probably, at least in the 3 years we've used it now, you know, it would track historically with what we used to see in RPI, but we know there's these other factors involved, some of these analytics that the RPI was just straight winning and losing and where you play the game. And that's still important, as we all know, but some of these other methods and such that come into the algorithm, you know, have tracked in a manner that we think it has been very valuable to the committee. But again, it's only one of the things we're looking at.
Yeah. So Tom, on that point, you know, I think one of the things that was revealed and discussed after the bracket was released last year by the chairman, Mitch Barnhart, was, so, you know, for selection purposes, it was heavily dependent on the resume based metrics, which I believe are the KPI and the strength of record. And then the predictive metrics, which you've listed a few, including Ken Palm and others, were heavily dependent on for seeding. I thought that was fairly interesting because when the bracket was revealed, some of my instant reactions were, you know, how is Missouri a 9 seed without any losses below quad 2A? How did UConn get up to the 7 line with just the one quad 1A win? So I think going back and retracing my steps after those comments, they all started to add up. So my real question now is, because I do think those questions are answered, is how do you feel about that now that you're the chairman? I know you still have to get the input of the other 11, but do you like the way that you guys put it together in 2021? And knowing this year, you will have quite a bit more data because we will have full schedules, fingers crossed, to get to the full 31 games, plus tournaments, conference tournaments. How do you feel about that process specifically? And, you know, because I do, another example of that was Syracuse not only getting in, but all the way into the main bracket and avoiding the first four. Can you just share maybe some learnings from last year and if any adjustments will be made this year?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that I don't think we will change, we definitely made a decision back in the summer. We're not changing what we, you know, knew of the details of the NET previously. And then, of course, you know, some of these other metrics that are used are you know, out of our control. You know, Ken Pomeroy is going to, you know, work on his metric, and the others will do the same. But I will tell you, having a fuller schedule, a full schedule, as we hope, will be very beneficial. I think the more data, the more results, because again, it's, you know, ultimately, regardless of metric, it's who you played, where you played them, and did you win or not? And that ultimately is what the committee is looking at, whether it's through the metrics, it's through our personal observations of teams across the country. And obviously that all comes to a head with selections in March. But I think, you know, the committee is in a really good place, you know, with the metrics we see. And again, on the team sheets we look at, we see everything. We see, you know, the ESPN BPI. We see their strength of record. Ken Palm, of course, KPI, Kevin Paga's metric, the Sagarin, of course, the net. We're looking at strength of schedule and all of that. So we've got as much information as you might imagine the committee would need. And, you know, I'm certainly in a comfortable place. And with a fuller schedule this year, I feel even better about it.
Yeah, Tom, I wanted to, this is more for the benefit of the audience. I kind of, we all know the answer to this already. The committee does not meet, you know, they don't get together, have the pasta dinner, and then go into the room and start deliberating. And that is the entire process. From the time the season tips at noon, you guys are tuned in every day, every night, all season long. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And then, you know, once we get going 3 weeks from tonight, you know, the conference monitoring assignments have been made, and everyone's watching their conferences. And obviously, as we've spoken about this before, is that every game matters. So even those games in November, you know, are going to have meaning, and we're going to have to, you know, track that. And what did this program do against, you know, with this opportunity? But that will continue all the way into selection week. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We might have a pasta dinner, but we don't they don't lock us in a room after that. We have the ability to continue watching games through selection week. We eat more than once, you might imagine, but we slow down the process at times when we feel like we need to talk more, or maybe watch a little bit more conference tournament action that final week. And we've got a viewing room to do that. And, you know, the process really begins. We come in on Tuesday night, we get to work on Wednesday, and that continues Thursday, Friday. Obviously Saturday is huge because of all the championship finals. And then we've got Sunday, where we may have some contingencies in place because we've got three or four or five tournaments being played. And if Team A wins versus Team B, there might be some differences in how the bracketing is done. So a lot of contingencies are kind of par for the course on Sunday as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And we actually try to mimic those a little bit ourselves, which is pretty fun actually for me.
Yeah. It's kind of funny to, like, I realize you have your full-time job as the conference commissioner, or the other 11 members have their full-time jobs either as commissioners or ADs, and they do this for free. We also have our full-time jobs, and then we do this for free, although no one cares because it's not the actual tournament.
Hey, Tom, I did have one other question for you. So I do sure. want to bring it back to the last time we saw a full season. In fact, I'm not even counting the 2020 ending because we didn't get through the process, right? So in 2019 and a few years before, we saw the first teams in history with 15 losses get into the field. But we do know that nobody above 15 losses, despite having just an abundance of Q1 and Q2 impressive wins from power leagues, have gotten in. And then we also know that, at least in recent history, no team worse than one game over 500 as an overall record have gotten in. I think the lowest has been two games over. So I, in my work in doing the mock simulations and doing my own bracketology, I pretty much treat it as a de facto disqualifier. Once a team hits 16 losses, or if they're just sitting at 500 and I'm looking, they've only got two, three games left, I don't think they're going to win them. I'm kind of leaving them way off the list until they show me something. I'm curious if the committee looks at those teams like that again. It's going to be, this year will be the first time we really have to address it again, because we will get up to such a high quantity of games, and teams with really good wins will get up to a high number of losses.
Yeah, you know, that, a great question. And I don't know that specifically, and I know for certain we don't have, you know, that kind of rule in place. I certainly understand and respect, you know, the personal feelings on how a team should be treated. But, you know, I think, you know, we're, you know, and you'll hear us say this as you have before, you know, we're looking at the full body of work and beginning in November. And, you know, could a team with maybe over a dozen losses still factor in? Well, it's going to depend, obviously, on what they did on the winning side of the ledger, who they played, how they did on the road, you know, what were, you know, records against common opponents. And sometimes when we get into comparisons at the very end and seeding or, you know, getting into the tournament period, there are things we're looking at that you could maybe, you know, split a hair about. And, you know, that becomes a differentiator in what we do. So we're looking at everything, certainly player and coach availability. That was a big thing, obviously, through COVID. But it can happen anytime with injury and such, or maybe a suspension here or there. And then, you know, you can't forget the computer metrics. Those are kind of always out there as well. But ultimately, it was 10. Now it's 12 of us. You know, we'll all come to our independent decisions. Yeah. On that type of team or anyone else in the bracket and how they should be placed, you know, where they wind up, or maybe on the outside looking in and maybe headed for the NIT.
Yeah. And just
go ahead, Rocco.
Just a quick follow up question on that. Do you ever, and this is personal, Tom, I know you're not privy to what the other members do, but do you personally go back and look at any other resumes from previous years that you served? I know last year I was looking back at, I think, 2018 or 19 TCU, a team that we thought was getting in, and I was trying to figure out why you left them out and then compare that to similar resumes last year, just for a lot of the same reasons. I'm just curious if you do stuff like that, where you look at previous selections and go off historical decisions and to maybe even make your case why a team should be in or out in the room.
Yeah, that's interesting. While I keep pretty good files on my previous experience, I don't know that I have really gone back and studied that. And I think part of that is we've got to understand that this year really doesn't relate to last year or the year before. So in the case you mentioned of maybe a TCU, you know, back in 18,
right.
You know, we're not carrying that over into 19 or 20 or 21. It's just not part of the direction that the committee has, and we've got to focus solely on this year. I think we're aware of the history, and you know, when you follow the bracket like all of you do, and a lot of fans, you certainly can remember, like I can remember that 85 Sweet 16 game with OU and Louisiana Tech like it was last night. But we all have that fondness and memory of the tournament. But I don't know that as a committee member, we can really go back and say, well, remember the team A in 2018 had this, and now we've got the same situation. Now we kind of wipe 2018, you know, off our memory and really try to stay focused on, you know, putting together everything for this year. So, I don't know that's the answer, but, you know, as a bracket historian as well, you have my salute on that, to go back and certainly remember details like that.
I can't remember what I did last week.
You mentioned injuries earlier, and it's a question that we debate a lot here at Hoops HD when we're discussing injuries. Just want to get your thoughts on how you evaluate significant injuries. I think there's two different situations too. The situation where maybe early or mid-season a team is missing a player, they lose a few games, but that player comes back and they're a lot more successful after his return. And on the contrast, the situation where a team is having a great season, but very late in the season, they lose a player Maybe they drop a few games with once he's lost, or maybe he's in lost late in the conference tournament. But that player is not going to be available for the NCAA tournament. And we know that going in. How do you treat both those
can
situations?
Can I add a third thing to that list, Chad?
Go ahead.
A win against a good team that is not in full strength for the team that won or lost, how is that evaluated?
It's great questions again, guys. And, you know, you've done your homework on this and really appreciate that. But, you know, what I would say is, and maybe just because it's most recent, the COVID experience last year when you would learn that player A was out for, you know, an extended period of time. Certainly we're watching how that team plays in those subset of games where that player is out. And sometimes they play right through it. And you'd never know that player was missing. But in the cases you're talking about, we do take that into account. And we do want to know, when is that player returning? When is that student athlete, you know, perhaps done with a virus, or maybe the twisted ankle is good enough to move forward? And sometimes that can extend over more than just a couple of games, as you know. It might be an injury in December, and now all of a sudden they have them back in March. And those are all things the committee takes into account. And again, that comes a lot out of the conference monitoring reports, where a committee member will tell you about this team out of this conference or that conference. So it's kind of all in the mix of everything we're looking at. Kind of hard for me to describe an exact situation there, but you know, you can be assured that nothing's going to get past the committee, in the sense that we're going to be very aware. We're talking to the conferences. We're talking to the conferences even through selections when we see an injury at a tournament, and we reach out and say, what's the status on player A or player B? So we're constantly updated. And, you know, that committee, that committee member will come back into the room and say, player A, they expect him to go in the semifinal tomorrow night. So we're in real time working through a lot of that. And that has been, I think, very beneficial. But that being said, you know, we get to a point where, you know, we can only take 68 teams into the tournament. And, you know, there may be other teams that were impacted by injuries, and we all know those stories that get left out of the tournament. But we're certainly monitoring that on an ongoing basis.
Yeah. Tom, what advice would you have for, again, under the radar teams that feel that they are good and they would like to make a case for themselves to the committee, but yet they're having trouble getting the kinds of games that they need to do that?
Yeah, great question. And it's difficult. And I will tell you, you know, we've had some experience with that in our conference. And yeah, there are just a lot of times where, yeah, you have in that case, I mean, SFA could not get a game in the state of Texas, even on someone else's home court. Mm-hmm. And as we know, there are some really good teams in this part of the country. So, but we faced that for a long time. And of course, it's very rare to get that kind of home game. But I think the key for the under the radar group is to try to find, obviously, winnable opportunities away from home. Now, that could be on someone else's home court, and you might say, well, easier said than done. But I would also offer that, you know, there are some MTE opportunities. There are some other tournament opportunities where, hey, maybe I can get this Power 5 team on a neutral court. And I think we see it every year. There's someone that's winning that game, a Belmont or someone else of that manner that's getting that. So, you know, coaches have got to be very aggressive in their scheduling opportunities, and that can be a challenge too. It's very easy for the conference commissioner to say that, but I will tell you, we continually preach to our coaches, and I would say this to any other coaches, that, you know, if there are opportunities to schedule up, and perhaps in a manner on a neutral floor that the committee is going to recognize as something, you know, substantial in their review of that team, that's where I think teams of our level really have to make their mark. And of course, you probably at our level, you've got to do really well in your conference schedule. You better, you know, go pretty substantial with, you know, very few losses and certainly very few home losses. So all of that gets measured in. But you want to have some positive marks, you know, if you can, in quad one, quad two, to a lesser degree, quad three. But if you're really heavy in the quad four, it's going to be very difficult for the under the radar team to break through.
Yeah, I'm still beating this drum that, you know, there are decent and good teams that are terrible on the road, and beating them on your home court is harder than maybe beating an under the radar school on their home court. So I hope you're with me in that. But, you know, you have sort of extreme examples. You had Long Beach State, who you would just look at their out of conference schedule and be like, my God, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I don't know if they do that anymore, but gee whiz. And again, is that a good, they're just going out and getting their heads kicked in.
Well, ultimately, you know, you do need to win games. You can't go out and play that kind of schedule and just get your, you know, brains beat in and, you know, expect the committee to see it as anything different than what it is. You know, if you go 0-8 in those games, you're 0-8. And now if you go 3-5 in those games, or maybe even win a couple of them, that's probably going to get the committee's attention. And we'll see how the rest of the season plays out. And if a team can do something like that and then kind of roll through their conference schedule to a large degree and then play well deep, at least into their tournament, then you'd be surprised. They're probably on the board somewhere. And now how long they're on the board and, you know, to what degree and do they ultimately advance? Well, that's a challenge because they're going to have to be really special and, you know, maybe win 28, 29 games to where, you know, anyone winning that amount of games is going to get the committee's attention.
Rocco, you have something else? We lost.
Tom, this has been an excellent, I didn't have anything further. You know, we could do this for hours, honestly. I want to be respectful of your time, but I appreciate you sitting down. It's a pleasure to be introduced to you.
Yeah, Tom, well, I want to echo that. And thank you so much for coming in. But I guess my last question is you can reveal to us now who the 4-1 seeds are going to be when the bracket comes out, right?
Interestingly enough, every team in the country right now is a number one seed. Everyone's undefeated. Yeah. Everyone's number one. Everyone's going to New Orleans. So how about that? That's my committee answer for today. Now in 3 weeks, all that's going to change.
Right. Well, then again, once again, we do want to thank you for coming on, spending the time with us. We really appreciate it, and wish you the best of luck throughout the season and hopefully we do have, as you, I think you mentioned earlier, a regular normal season this year, because we really, really need it.
And Tom, if you need our help, we're right here.
Yeah, make sure I have your phone numbers and get in touch with you guys immediately when I have a question. But hey guys, sure. It's been a pleasure. Really, really, you know, from an under the radar conference, greatly appreciate what you guys do and keeping the spotlight on this great sport, but some, you know, more particularly on some specific programs that may not get the notice, may not be on television every night. And I think that's really good and healthy for the sport. So appreciate all you guys do for us.
Thanks. That means a lot coming from you.
Thanks again. And thanks again to our special guest, NCAA Tournament Selection Committee Chairman and Southland Conference Commissioner Tom Burnett, also Rocco Miller from Bracketeer.org, David Griggs. I'm Chad Sherwood. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We will be talking to you again real soon.